Hare Deva
Abhay had been a devotee of Lord Chaitanya since childhood, and he was familiar with the life of Lord Chaitanya through the well-known scriptures Chaitanya Charitamrita and Chaitanya Bhagavat. He had learned of Lord Chaitanya not only as the most ecstatic form of a pure devotee, who had spread the chanting of the holy name to all parts of India, but also as the direct appearance of Sri Krishna himself in the form of Radha and Krishna combined. But now, for the first time, Abhay was in touch with the great wealth of literature compiled by the Lord's immediate associates and followers, passed down in disciplic succession, and expanded on by great authorities. Lord Chaitanya's immediate followers, Srila Rupa Goswami, Srila Sanatana Goswami, Srila Jiva Goswami, and others, had compiled many volumes based on the Vedic scriptures, and proving conclusively that Lord Chaitanya's teachings were the essence of Vedic wisdom. There were many books not yet published, but Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was intent on establishing many presses, just to release the sound of the Brihat Madanga for the benefit of all people. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was teaching the conclusion of Lord Chaitanya's teachings, that Lord Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that chanting of his holy name should be stressed above other religious practices. In former ages, other methods of attaining to God had been available, but in the present age of Kali, only the chanting of Hare Krishna would be effective. On the authority of the scriptures, such as the Brihan Naradiya Purana and the Upanishads, Bhaktivinoda Thakur had specifically cited the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Lord Krishna himself had confirmed in Bhagavad Gita that the only method of attaining him was devotional service. Quote, abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. I shall deliver you from all sinful reactions. Do not fear. Abhay knew these verses, he knew the chanting, and he knew the conclusions of the Gita. But now, as he eagerly read the writings of the great Acharyas, he had fresh realizations of the scope of Lord Chaitanya's mission. Now he was discovering the depth of his own Vaishnava heritage and its efficacy for bringing about the highest welfare for people in an age destined to be full of troubles. So this very important to notice is because of one person, then all these literatures were being made available. Otherwise, then they were hard to find. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, when he wanted a copy of Chaitanya Charitamrita to read, it took him 8 years to find one. Right? 8 years he searched. Then he having gotten it, then he published it and that, and then his son published it and so like that. So it's actually because of, you know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and Srila Prabhupada, that all these works are available. We take it for granted. Everybody has Bhagavatam, everybody has Chaitanya Charitamrita. You go into every house, basically, there's so many books like that. But that's actually because, you know, of the Acharyas, like that. Now people may do it because, and they may get, you know, money from it, this, that. That may be inspire them. But here it was that the concept of printing books, that's because of these Acharyas. right? They make it. So, what do you think? Yes? So is it good that so many books are available? Or is it a problem because then there's so many books you have to read? What do you think? I guess you could just look at the pictures also. So lots of pictures, so that's a nice thing, no? Is that a nice thing? You're not sure? Yeah? You work on telepathy or something? Or like that? Okay. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta was often traveling, and Abhay was busy with his family and business. So to arrange another meeting was not possible. Yet from their first encounter, Abhay had considered Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati his spiritual master, and Abhay began thinking of him always. I have met such a nice saintly person. Whenever possible, Abhay would seek out Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's disciples, the members of the Gaudiya Mutt. As for Gandhi's movement, Gandhi had suffered a bitter setback when his nonviolent followers had blundered and committed violence during a protest. The British had taken the opportunity to arrest Gandhi and sentence him to 6 years in jail. Although his followers still revered him, the nationalist movement had lost much of its impetus. But regardless of that, Abhay was no longer interested. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had defeated his idea that the nationalist cause was India's first priority. He had invoked Abhay's original Krishna consciousness, and Abhay now felt confident that Bhaktisiddhanta's mission was the real priority. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta had invited him to preach, and from that moment Abhay had wanted to join the Gaudiya Mutt as one of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's disciples. But now, instead of his political inclinations, it was his family obligations that stood in the way. He was no longer thinking, first let us become an independent nation, then preach about Lord Chaitanya. Now he was thinking, I cannot take part like the others. I have my family responsibilities. Right? So one has to be able to see the priorities in that. You know, how to judge what has to be done, what is not to be done. So here then, between nationalism as a cause and spiritual activity, then it's not that only when we're free, then we can practice what we want. No, that can be practiced anyway. Right? You can be God conscious in any situation. Does that make sense? So it goes on nicely, like we see in Russia, the devotees there, even though the communist government didn't appreciate religion, the devotees were still practicing. They were still practicing. We had to be very careful, but, you know, it would make them very aware, but they could practice. So India wasn't having a problem of religious freedom. And so one could be Krishna conscious with not a problem. Right? But the thing was is that the idea gets there that this is very, very important, but that's not as important as Krishna consciousness. Right? One has to be able to see the difference. Then now within that, within one's own sadhana and practices, then depending upon one's ashram and that will give more or less time for specific activities. So one is always trying to organize one's life so that one can get the maximum amount of time involved in Krishna conscious activities. Right? That's always what one tries to do. So one has to make a balance between the Krishna conscious, you know, activities of preaching and other things like that, along with then one's sadhana and one's family obligations. So one has to find out how to make all that work together. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. And the family was growing. In 1921, Abhay and his wife had their first child, and there would be more children, and more income would be needed. Earning money meant sacrificing time and energy, and it meant, at least externally, being distracted from the mission of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Indian culture had the highest regard for the family institution, and divorce was unheard of. Even if a man was in great financial difficulty, he would remain with his wife and children. Although Abhay expressed regret at not being a sannyasi disciple in the Gaudiya Mutt, He never seriously considered leaving his young wife so early in their marriage. Gormohan was pleased to hear of his son's attraction to a Vaishnav guru, but he never expected Abai to abandon responsibilities and enter the renounced order. A Vaishnava should remain with wife and family, practice spiritual life at home, and even become active in preaching. Abai would have to find ways to serve the mission of Bhaktisiddhanta as a family man. Like, so Prabhupada had become a devotee because his father was so committed to the process. Right? He wanted to see that he was, you know, worshiping the deity, learning Madanga, you know, associating with saintly persons, hearing, you know, Krishna Katha like this. That was very important to him. So he was seeing that all that was going on. So then like that, then Srila Prabhupada became Krishna conscious. So then when the children are properly established, they're properly, you know, performing their own duties, that's the time then one can move on from there. Otherwise, if one finds one doesn't have a need for the interactions of married life, then one doesn't have to enter into it. But the point is, if one needs that interaction, one feels comfortable in that, then that should be accepted, and then one should move in that way. Does that make sense? And then make all these adjustments, right? One doesn't adjust them in such a way that any one of them becomes, reduced. But at the same time, you know, one has to see that Krishna consciousness is always the priority. One has to see, because in the family life, one can make that also Krishna conscious. Yes? What do you think? Abai thought if he were to become very successful in business, then he could spend money not only to support his family, but also to help support Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's mission of spreading Krishna consciousness. An astrologer had even predicted that Abai would become one of the wealthiest men in India. But with his present income, he could do little more than provide for his family needs. He thought he might do better by trying to develop a business on his own. Abai expressed his feelings to Dr. Bose, who listened like a sympathetic father, and suggested that Abai become his agent for all of northern India. Abai could purchase medicines, liniments, rectified spirits, toothpaste, and other items wholesale from Mr. Bose's factory, and travel widely throughout the northern India, building up his own business. Also, Abai had enough experience with Bose's laboratory that he could try to make and market some of his own medicines and products. Dr. Bose and Abai decided that the centrally located city of Allahabad would be a good place for Abai to make his headquarters. Like that. I think there's, I forget which one it is, but there's a, some, you see a picture of it, where Prabhupada had made his own medicine. I think he had Day's liniment or something, and they had a picture of him on the front there. And, in 1923, Abai and his wife and child moved to Allahabad, a 12-hour train ride northwest from Calcutta. The British had once made Allahabad the capital of the United Provinces, and they had built many good buildings there, including buildings for a high court and a university. Europeans and affluent Indian families like the Nehrus lived in a modern, paved, well-lit section of the town. There was also another, older section with ancient, narrow streets closely lined with buildings and shops. Many Bengalis resided there, and it was there that Abai decided to settle his family. He had chosen Allahabad, traditionally known as Prayag, as a good location for his business. But it was also one of India's most famous places of pilgrimage. Why, what's it, Prayag? Where the Ganga and the Saraswati come together. Okay? Anything else? Yamuna also. It depends where you're looking from. If you're looking downstream, then yes, Yamuna's on the right. But if you're looking upstream, Yamuna would be on the... No, Yamuna would be Yeah, on the right. Now, if you're looking upstream, it would be on the left. That's what you meant? When you said Jamuna right? No.
Jamuna also mixes there too.
Jamuna also mixes there too. But there's three. Why are you saying two? Ganga, Jamuna, and Saraswati. That's how many?
Three.
Right? So then you would say, Jamuna also three. Right? You could also say right. Yes? No? Okay. But Saraswati, you only see Ganga and Jamuna. Saraswati comes up from the bottom. And she comes underground and then comes. Like that. Originally, you could see her, but then at one point she disappeared. Like that. Situated at the confluence of the three holiest rivers of India, the Ganga, the Jamuna, and the Saraswati, Allahabad was the site of two of India's most widely attended spiritual events, the annual Magh Mela and the Kumbh Mela, which took place every 12 years. And in search of spiritual purification, millions of pilgrims from all over India would converge here each year at the time of the full moon in the month of Magh, January, and bathe in the junction of the three sacred rivers. So what would be special about the situation of bathing at Prayag in January?
It's very cold.
It's very cold. So, yeah, very, very cold. So therefore, it's not like you're just going for a holiday. Everyone go down there, you know, hang out on the beach, you know. It's like, it's freezing cold. I mean, really cold. And so to take bath there means you're there for spiritual purposes. You're not there for, you know, something else. Abai's home at 60 Badshahi Mundi consisted of a few rented rooms. For his business, he rented a small shop in the commercial center of the city at Johnston Gung Road, where he opened his dispensary, Prayag Pharmacy, and began selling medicines, tinctures, syrups, and other products manufactured by Bosch's laboratory. He met an Allahabad physician, Dr. Ghosh, who was interested in a business partnership, so Abai asked him to become his attending physician and move his office to Prayag Pharmacy. Dr. Ghosh consented and closed his own shop, Tropical Pharmacy. So, yeah. So now if you have them both together, what's the advantage?
One Abai takes care of their own medicine and all that, and then Dr. Ghosh takes care of it. He sees what the people have.
Okay, so Dr. Go, yeah, means Abai takes care of the medicine and the doctor takes care of seeing patients.
Also, anywhere that needs to go to the doctor will see the medicines. Anywhere that needs to see medicines will see the doctor too.
So. Okay, so who needs medicines will see the doctor. Who sees the doctor sees medicines. Anything else taking it a step further? Okay, yeah, for practical, if one's there, the other, like this, could manage a shop because they're partners. But it's something very close. That would be very practical, so that way then someone could go out. Remember, he was supposed to go out and travel also in India in north to see that his medicines were being sold.
So the business grows.
The business grows. Why does the business grow?
Because both of them, they have their own dispensaries. They're combining.
They're combining? Okay, so that would mean you stock. But what's the practical point of this combination? Adi almost said it.
There's only one pharmacy?
Now there's only one pharmacy, meaning that Abai has no competition, or?
Well, the customers from his old customers.
Yes, so now, yeah, so you get the other customers would come instead of buying from that, they buy here, but at the same time as they still have to split the profit.
Partnership makes profit?
Partnership makes profit. Generally can, what is it? Many hands make work light.
Too many cooks spoil the broth.
It's too many cooks spoil the broth.
It also means any patients to get an easy
It?
The doctor will send the patients.
Ah, that's the point. The point is they'll go to the doctor. The doctor will prescribe medicine. Now, where will they buy that medicine? Right? From the shop. You understand? So that's why so many times you see dispensaries and doctors, they all go together. Does that make sense? Because a doctor will always prescribe medicine. And so then you have to buy the medicine. That way then the both of them are working together. Does that make sense? You understand? Because you almost said that. But didn't quite hit the point. Yes? At Prayag Pharmacy, Dr. Ghosh would diagnose patients and give medical prescriptions, which Abhay would fill. Dr. Ghosh would then receive a 25% commission from the sale of the prescriptions. Abhay and Dr. Ghosh became friends. They would visit at each other's homes, and they would treat each other's children like their own. And they treated each other's children like their own family members. Often they discussed their aspirations for increasing profits. Right? So here is they became friends, they worked together, it's like family. Right? So then the partnership was very nice. So not only does this increase economic profits, but also just, you know, social relationships and everything become enhanced there. Dr. Ghosh. Abhay was a business-minded man. We were all God-fearing, of course. In every home we have a small temple, and we must have deities. But he used to always talk about business and how to meet family expenses. Although at home Abhay wore a kurta and dhoti, sometimes for business he would dress in shirt and pants. He was a good-looking, full-mustached, energetic young man in his late 20s. Right? No, he didn't have one of these little thin little ones like this, you know, look like he didn't, you know, brush. Yeah, he could. Clean above your lip, you know, had one of those very big, big mustaches. He and Radharani Day now had two children, a daughter who was born after they had been in Allahabad 1 year. Gaur Mohan, who was now, oh, some of that was his son. Gaur Mohan is now 75. I was thinking, how did that happen? His son was, that's his father. Had come to live with him, and as had Abhay's divorced widowed sister, Rajeshwari, and her son, Tulsi. Gaur Mohan mostly stayed at home, chanted on his beads, and worshipped the Shaligram Shila deity of Krishna. He was satisfied that Abhay was doing right, and Abhay was satisfied to have his father living comfortably with him and freely worshipping Krishna. So now his father could just sit down and absorb himself there. Plus, he's taking care of his sister and her son. You know, so everything's developing nicely. Abhay led a busy life. He was intent on building his business. By 8 a.m., he would go to his pharmacy, where he would meet Dr. Ghosh and begin his day's work. At noon, he would come home, and then he would return to his pharmacy in the late afternoon. He had purchased a large Buick for 8,000 rupees. And although he never drove it himself, he let his nephew, a good driver, use it for his taxi business. Occasionally, Abhay would use the car on his own business excursions, and his nephew would then act as a chauffeur. So this may be the car that when Prabhupada talked with Graham Hill, he was a famous, in the 60s, famous Formula One race car driver, so they talked about cars. May have been the Buick he talked about, maybe something else. It so happened that both Motilal Nehru and his son Jawaharlal Nehru were customers at Prayag Pharmacy. Abhay thought he must have felt that Indian ways were inferior. Once Jawaharlal approached Abhay for a political contribution, and Abhay donated, being a conscientious merchant. During the day, Abhay would talk with his customers and other friends who would stop by, and they would tell him many things. A former military officer used to tell Abhay stories of World War I. He told how Marshal Foch in France had one day ordered the killing of thousands of Belgian refugees whose maintenance had become a burden to him on the battlefield. How would you say that? F-O-C-H? Foch, okay. Yeah, so in other words, it's that they're talking how they're so nice, or the allies, they're the, you know, upholders of this and that. But they had, in France, Belgian refugees who were, you know, supportive like that, but because they couldn't take care of them and run the war, so then they killed them, thousands of them, like that. World War II also, I think the Allies did the same thing in Dresden. I think it was 25,000 people surrendered to the Allies, you know, citizens, not army, citizens. Like that. And so because they felt it would be too difficult to manage and this and that, then they just bombed the city where all the people were, killed them all, you know. And so, but somehow or another, they're always the good guys. A Mohammedan gentleman, a member of a royal family in Afghanistan, would come daily with his son to sit and chat. Abai would listen to his visitors and converse pleasantly and make up their prescriptions. But his thoughts kept returning to this meeting with Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. He went over it again and again in his mind, how he had looked, his mannerisms, what he had said. At night, so it's like he's doing very nicely in all these things, but at the same time he's absorbed in, you know, his what he wants to get to. At night, Abai would go home to his wife and children. Radharani was a chaste and faithful wife, who spent her days cooking, cleaning, and caring for her two children. But she was not inclined to share her husband's interest in things spiritual. He could not convey to her his feelings about Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. So we see this here is, materially it can work very nicely, but spiritually it's not so great. So one should try to see that the material and spiritual are connected, right? Abai, his wife, their two children, Gaur Mohan, Abai's younger brother, Krishnacharan, Abai's widowed sister, Rajeshwari, and her son, Tulsidas, all went together to an Allahabad studio for a family portrait. The photo shows Abai in his late 20s. He is thin and dark, with a full mustache. His forehead is broad, his eyes dark and clear. He wears a white kurta and a dhoti and plain dark slippers. He sits on a chair, his wife standing behind him, an attractive young woman in a white khadi sari with a line of color on the border. Her slim arm rests behind Abai's head on the back of his chair, her small hand gripping the edge of the chair. Her left hand hangs on her side, gripped in a fist. She is barefoot. With his left hand, Abai steadies his two-year-old boy, Pacha Prayagraj, a glaring infant, on his lap, the boy seeming to squirm, his baby legs and bare feet dangling by his mother's knee. Abai seems a bit amused by the son on his lap. Abai is a handsome Indian man, his wife an attractive woman, both young. Also behind Abai stands his nephew, Tulsi, and his brother, Krishnacharan. Sitting on the far right is Abai's sister, Rajeshwari, dressed in a widow's white sari, holding Sulakshmana, Abai's daughter, on her lap. Sulakshmana is also squirming, her foot jutting towards the photographer. In the center sits Gaur Mohan. His face is shriveled, and his whole body is emaciated with age. He is wearing a white kurta and dhoti. His hands seem to be moving actively on his lap, perhaps with palsy. He is short and small and old. I think, and I know if Sulakshmana, his sister, is still in Calcutta, brother's sister. No, Sulakshmana is not his sister, his daughter, excuse me. Abai traveled frequently throughout northern India, intent on expanding his sales. It was not unusual for him to be gone a few days in a week, and sometimes a week or more at a time, as he traveled from one city to another. The pharmaceutical industry was just beginning in India, and doctors, hospitals, and pharmacies were eager to buy from the competent, gentlemanly agent who called on them from Bose's laboratory of Calcutta. He would travel by train and stay in hotels. He liked the feeling of freedom from home that traveling afforded, but the real drive was servicing was servicing accounts and getting new ones. That was his business. Riding in a third-class unreserved compartment was often uncomfortable. The only seats were benches, which were often dirty. And passengers were permitted to crowd on without reservations. And that is how Abai traveled, hundreds of miles every week. In those days, you don't see the bogies anymore, I don't think. Now the unreserved is a regular three-tiered, you know, bogie with the six, the six seats on one side. But the original ones, they only had two beds. You know, they were a bit longer. I'm not even sure that there wasn't the side seats. They were just much longer so that more people could sit. And because unreserved meant most people were sitting. And I'm not sure if the top one wasn't reserved or not, but in any case. But they were basically a bit of a nightmare to get on like that. As the train moved between towns, he would see the numberless small villages and then the country land that spread out before him on either side of the tracks. At every stop, he would hear the cries of the tea vendors as they walked alongside the train windows, saying,
"Try, try."
Yeah. The British had introduced it, and now millions of Indians were convinced that they could not get through the morning without their little glass of hot tea. As a strict Vaishnava, Abai never touched it, but his wife, much to his displeasure, was becoming a regular tea drinker. Because right? Yeah, originally the Indians didn't drink tea. It means they'd had your tea with means like herbs and stuff like that. But it was something that you took, you know, either when it was cold or when you were sick or like that kind of a thing. But then the British, then they brought tea from China and introduced it into India. What they did is they'd make the tea and then set up these like a pandal, you know, with seats and everything like that. And they'd invite the Indians and, you know, for every cup of tea they'd drink, they'd give them money. They'd pay them to drink the tea. Then after a while, when people were very, very regular at drinking it, they started reducing how much they paid until they brought it to the point where it was free. You know, they didn't give you anything, but, you know, you could drink the tea. And then as they were confident that the Indians were very attached to drinking the tea, then they started charging a very minimal amount of money. And then slowly, slowly built it up until it was a proper price where they could make profit. So that means they spent, I'm not sure how many years, getting the whole of India addicted to tea. At the same time, in India, they were growing opium, because here the Indians wouldn't use the opium, they would grow, you know, make for poppy seeds for cooking, like that. But the British farmed opium farmed the poppy seeds to make opium. And then that they sold to the Chinese, and they got them addicted to that. Right? And so then the Chinese at one point got very disgusted with it and said, "We're not going to buy it. You can't bring your opium." And then the British started a war, and they burnt down the Summer Palace, which was a huge, it's probably like from here to the temple. Amazing, you know, old, centuries-old palace. They burnt it down. And then the Chinese agreed to, you know, allow him to sell opium to their people. So we can see is that much of the British wealth of their empire actually came from the drug trade. You know, that's what they did. And not that they just let it, you know, out and whoever on the street buy it. They actually made great efforts to make the mass of people addicted to their drugs, and then that way then create their business. Right? And they're supposed to be the good guys, right?
Drugs and plunder.
Huh? Yeah, drugs and then plunder. You tell the farmers that they can only grow this crop, and then if there's too much of it, then they tell them we're not interested, we're not buying it. And in this way, then, they were very, very pleasantly managed their empire to the point where nobody wanted to work under them anymore, and they all gained their freedoms. Although Abai was accustomed to dressing as a European businessman, he never compromised the strict Vaishnava principles. Most of his fellow Bengalis had taken up fish eating, but Abai was always careful to avoid non-Vaishnava foods, even at hotels. Once at a vegetarian hotel, the Empire Hindu Hotel in Bombay, he was served onions, and sometimes hotel people tried to serve him mushrooms, garlic, and even eggs. But all of these he carefully avoided, keeping a small semblance of his home routine. He would take his bath early in the morning with cold water. He followed this routine year-round, and when, in Saharanpur, he did so during the bitter cold winter, the hotel keeper was greatly surprised. Prabhupada, I think he mentioned to, who was Panchadevita? Yeah, Prabhupada was telling Panchadevita, or devotees, and Panchadevita was there and heard of that. Prabhupada was saying is that when you're taking a cold bath, then the main place is that before putting water on your head, you have to put it on your back. Because all the nerves are in your back, so if you put water on your back, then it'll be cold, but you won't feel it then when you put water on your head. And also, when you dry off, if it's cold, dry your back first. In the West, they say dry your head first, because the most heat goes out of your head, which is true. But you don't feel it, right? Your head's one big bone, so you don't notice it so much, right? But you notice it on the back because of all the nerves. So if you dry your back first, you won't feel cold. Like that. Then dry your head, yes.
Yeah. Also, you don't. Pathogenic influence comes in from the back.
Pathogenic influence comes in from the back. Okay.
Comes in from
the neck and back. Yes? Means, in other words, you get sick from. Yeah.
What is pathogenic?
Pathogenic would mean, medical considerations of things that make you sick. You know, getting too cold or too hot or too this or too that. It affects you through the back and the neck as opposed to the head. Probably unless you're out in the sun, direct sun, you know, walking through the Sahara Desert, you know, then it might go into your head or something. And then a finer point of that is that based on the same principle, where the back is important, then up in the Himalayas where they bathe, you know, that's just regular water, but they're bathing with ice water. And so, you know, like at the Gangotri and that. So then they take it that you, when you're bathing with the cold water, if you put it on your navel first, right, then the same place on your back, then do your legs, then do your arms, then do your back, then head. Then you won't feel the cold like that. So if you're more sensitive to cold, follow all that. If you're less sensitive, start with your back and then the head. Yes? No. What do you think? Abai conversed with many people in his travels. A doctor in Dhaka had told him that on his way to the office, he had passed a farmer talking to a friend and can tell by the sound of the farmer's cough that the farmer would die within a few hours. Another doctor told Abai that he had just come from seeing a pneumonia patient who was defying nature and medical science by continuing to live. He met a Mohammedan doctor in Gaya who lamented that he had just lost a patient, although he had given the man the very best medicine. Right, so you can see his problems. We've gotten Dhaka, which is in Bangladesh, right? Bombay, which is on all the way on the other side of India, right? And then he's traveling in north and all that. So Saharanpur must be up north, otherwise why would the person be impressed that he was bathing in cold water? Because right? Bombay is not cold in the winter. So that's quite a wide range of traveling. Such accounts from men of the medical profession confirms Abai's conviction that without God's sanction, no one could be saved. Not that he ever thought of his medical sales as philanthropic work. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had already convinced him that the only way to serve a person was by giving him Krishna consciousness. Abai's medical products were strictly for business. Right? So he knew it makes money. You know, people need it, then they do it. But it's simply by Krishna's, you know, blessing that things will go on. If Krishna wants to save you, no one can bother you. If Krishna wants to, you know, if Krishna's going to kill you, no one can save you. So we can see here is the doctors are giving the medical treatment, but according to the patient's karma, they do well or not. Does that make sense? Right. On one business trip, it was in 1925, he traveled through Agra, only 40 miles south of Vrindavan. Taking the opportunity, he made his first visit to Holy Vrindavan, fulfilling his childhood aspiration. He loved the sight of Vrindavan, but he could spend only a day or two. Even a single day away from his sales work could be critical. As a reverent pilgrim, Abai visited a few temples, especially the principal temples established by the followers of Lord Chaitanya. But he had to move on. Right? Who knows what the principal temples are? Madan Mohan, Govinda, and Gopinath. Okay? Radha Damodar. Radha Shyam Sundar. Radha Raman. Bunky Bihari. Not exactly. Means that is, you could say, the most visited temple in Vrindavan, but that is in Haridasa's line. So I think they're Nimbarkas, like that. So it's a different line. Radha Gokulananda, right? It's right next to, right down, Radha Raman. Okay? So those are all the Goswami's temples. There were also risks in traveling. Once he was sitting in a train compartment in Mathura station when a monkey suddenly entered and took away his belongings. Early one morning before dawn, while he was on his way to Kanpur in a two-wheeled horse carriage, the horse was going at a fast trot when suddenly it hit a large heap of rubbish in the middle of the road. The carriage turned upside down. Horse, driver, and carriage all landed in a heap, and Abai was thrown into the air. But he landed unharmed, feeling as though he had just changed to another seat. Because Abai sat but said nothing, the driver thought he had been knocked unconscious and became anxious. The passenger was all right, however, and the driver considered it a miracle, since the cart had so violently ejected him. Abai took it that he had been saved by Krishna, and he remembered similar incidents starting with his childhood. When his clothing had caught on fire, Krishna had always protected him. For 5 years, Abai traveled widely out of Allahabad, and when he was home, he put in long hours at the dispensary. But he also spent time with his wife and played with his children. Srila Prabhupada, when my son was about 2 years old, he was very naughty, always doing some mischief. My friends used to visit me and call my son Pacha. Pacha, if you sit down for 1 minute silently, I will give you a gift. That's what they say. But the boy failed. 1 minute, I couldn't sit there like that. He wouldn't know anybody like that, would he? Like that.
Not a few. Not one. Few.
You know a few. Maybe we should put it in the other. Is there anyone here who could sit down for 1 minute without... Okay. But the boy failed. He could not sit down even for a minute. There was a table found, and Pacha was wanting to touch it. I said, no, no, don't touch. But again he tried to touch it. So my friend said, just lower the speed and let him touch it. So I unplugged the fan, and when he touched it, it did not harm him. But it hit his finger with a loud noise, tong, and he would not touch again. I would ask him, touch again? But he would not. He wants to say, touch, you want to touch again? like that. Very interesting how they do, right? They're not, they figure out a way that the kid can do it that he won't do it anymore, right? And then after that, they encourage him and then make it even more, you know. As soon as his daughter, Sulakshmana, could speak, he began teaching her the Bengali translation of the prayer, Guru Vastukam, which begins, "The spiritual master is receiving benedictions from the ocean of mercy. Just as a cloud pours water on a forest fire to extinguish it, the spiritual master extinguishes the blazing fire of material existence, of repeated birth and death." Right? That's for, as soon as she can speak, that's the first thing she learns, right? It's the Guru Vastika. Except for his obligatory travels, Abhay stayed at home and satisfied his family. He tended diligently to his business, and it prospered. It was Kumbh Mela, January 1928. Bhakti Pradeep Tirtha Maharaj of the Gaudiya Math had come to Allahabad with a few men. Bhakti Pradeep Tirtha, Bhakti Vilas Tirtha, Bhakti... which one is Bhakti Pradeep? I think Bhakti Pradeep was the old... One day he walked unannounced into the Prayag pharmacy, and all of a sudden Abhay was seeing them again after so many years. "Oh, these are the people I saw before," he thought. "Gaudiya Math, yes, come in." Bhakti Pradeep Tirtha Swami was the same sannyasi who had visited Narendranath Malik in Calcutta, a visit that had led to Abhay's going to visit Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Folding his palms in a humble gesture, standing before Abhay in simple saffron khadi robes, his shaven head and a tuft of sika in the back, his forehead marked with Vaishnava tilak, Tirthamara said to Abhay, "We are new here. We are going to establish a temple in Allahabad. We have heard your name, so we have come to you. Please help us." Abhay was joyful. "Yes, I will help you." He contributed what money he could and then introduced Tirtha Maharaj to Dr. Ghosh, who also contributed. Abhay invited the Gaudiya Math devotees to come to his home and hold a bhajan and lecture. His wife would cook prasadam. They accepted, but when they arrived there, there was a misunderstanding. Gaur Mohan, who was invalid, was staying in his room upstairs. "Please come down," Abhay called. "There is a meeting of the Gaudiya Math." Gaur Mohan came downstairs, but when he saw the sadhus, he mistook them for impersonalists from a non-devotional mission. He had not heard correctly what Abhay had said. Gaur Mohan took a seat, but he observed the saffron-clad men sullenly and even made a critical remark. Abhay, who was enlivened at the opportunity to associate with the Vaishnavas and hear from them Krishna Katha, could not understand his father's behavior. Then, as soon as Bhakti Pradeep Tirtha Swami began his lecture, Gaur Mohan understood, "Oh, they are Vaishnavas," he cried. Old and invalid as he was, he immediately fell down at their feet. "I misunderstood you, sir. I thought you were sannyasis from another mission. I am glad to meet you." So even though he would invite sadhus over and things like that, you know, the benefits from that, but still, you know, if they were not Vaishnavas, he didn't necessarily have good things to say. After Kumbh Mela, Pradeep Tirtha Swami left, but five or six brahmachari disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati stayed on in Allahabad, maintaining a small mutt headquarters. They worshipped the deity, held an evening program of kirtan and lecture, and preached actively to the local people. The devotee in charge, Atulananda Brahmachari, would visit the homes of Allahabad citizens, trying to solicit subscriber members for the mat. For half a rupee per month, a person would receive a subscription to the Gaudiya Math magazine, 50 pais. So that was the going rate of a donation in those days. In the course of his door-to-door soliciting, Atulananda knocked on the door of Abhay Charan Day. Abhay received him very hospitably and offered him some rice and fruit. Abhay was very receptive to the philosophy and relished discussions with Atulananda, who made it a point to visit Dr. Day repeatedly and speak with him about Lord Chaitanya and the Bhagavad Gita. Abhay also inquired into the recent activities of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. By now, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta had established the Gaudiya printing works in Calcutta and had begun to publish the Srimad Bhagavatam in several volumes with his own annotations. He also published an edited version of Sri Chaitanya Bhagavat from his center in Dhaka. He had opened centers in Bhubaneswar, Madras, and Puri. Abhay's interest was insatiable. Atulananda told him how in 1925, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had led a big procession, a circumambulating the holy land of Navadvip, with deities riding on the backs of gorgeously decorated elephants, and with devotees from all parts of India attending.
Right, so he would use elephants and stuff like that. So, you know, it's the tradition. Now, sometimes they would criticize us, saying, you know, it's Vaikuntha, elephants, so much opulence and that. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur did things very big. You know, he'd drive around in a Jaguar. He had his own personal launch that he would go out in the morning and take the gentlemen of Calcutta and preach to them on. So there was great opulence in that. Okay, so